This is Vermont Edition. I'm Michaela LaFrac. Happy Town Meeting Day to all those who celebrate. I live in a municipality that votes by Australian ballot. It's a useful and efficient form of democracy, but I am always a little bit jealous of those of you who get to gather in a church, fire station, or school to debate town issues in person. Have you already voted today at a polling place? What issue brought you to the polls or brought you to your town meeting gathering? Maybe you're heading there right now. What's your favorite tradition that you're looking forward to participating in? You could call in throughout this hour at 800-639-2211 or send us an email about your town meeting day to vermontedition@vermontpublic.org. Now, history often repeats itself at Town Meeting Day, but that doesn't make it any less interesting. Later in the show, we're going to hear about how, over the last four or so decades, Vermont towns have had debates on national and international issues, as well as local ones. We're also going to hear a fascinating story from a town meeting in 1982, so be sure to stay tuned for that. Vermont Public has reporters stationed all across the state today. We're going to head first to Rutland, where a mayoral race is bringing many residents to the polls. Incumbent Michael Dungis is being challenged by former Rutland City Clerk Henry Heck. Nina Keck is stationed in Rutland. Nina, welcome.
Hey, thanks.
So what's the mood and turnout been like so far at Town Meeting Day?
Well, I've been going to the various polling locations this morning, and it felt kind of sleepy. I'm at the Godnick Community Center right now, surrounded by a sea of colorful political signs. It's kind of surreal. And things are really picking up with the lunch rush coming in to vote. So I think it's been steady with voters, but there's been you mentioned the mayor's race, yeah, which is, I think, what people are talking about. There's no big polarizing other issue, like a $30 million bond vote for a new sports complex or fluoridation that has come up before in Rutland that get a lot of people talking on both sides. So, yeah, the focus this election has definitely been on the mayor's race. And I've been hearing from a lot of voters this morning who like both candidates. Michael Dungis, the incumbent, people point to the fact that, hey, he's young, he's got a lot of energy, he's 44. They like what he's been doing about promoting housing in Rutland. They like that he is making progress with a proposed hotel for the downtown here using a TIF district funding mechanism that'll help make cleanup of certain downtown sites easier for developers. There's been a lot of momentum behind him. People are also very familiar with Henry Heck, the challenger, who was the city clerk, as you mentioned, for 14 years. He currently sits on the board of aldermen. People like both candidates, but there was a problem about last month. Henry Heck got in some trouble when he made some disparaging comments about the police department. And that, I'm finding, talking to voters this morning, is definitely having some blowback. And I will play some tape in a second, but just for some backstory on that, Henry Heck was doing a campaign event that was live streamed on Facebook in February and talked about contract negotiations. He's a sitting member of the Board of Aldermen, so that's, city officials are not supposed to do that. He commented that police want to work 40 hours and get paid for 60 hours of work. He made some other disparaging comments. And a lot of voters I talked to this morning said that left a real sour taste in their mouth, including Janice Semp, who said this to me.
I heard the issue with Heck talking about the police department, and that totally changed my mind. The way he quoted someone else and it kind of came off as his own, but our police need as much support as we can give them, I believe. And that just changed my vote to Mayor Mike.
Well, I heard that from probably half a dozen voters who said
they'd
been. Yeah, I was surprised. I said I was keeping an open mind. I like both men. Didn't know who I was going to vote for, but that bothered me. And unions in the city came out, including the union representing police officers, came out and endorsed Dungis. So that could be a real tough hurdle for him to get over. Heck, I'm talking about.
Yeah.
But we'll see. He's got a strong contingent of supporters too in the city. But people are talking about the mayor's race, it's interesting.
Yeah, and I'm glad you brought up the connections to the housing shortage, because not just in Rutland, but all across the state, I feel like the many, many votes and conversations going on town meeting day today connect back to housing, not just with the leaders we're electing, but other policies. Is that coming up in other ways in Rutland?
Yeah, you know, one of the things that people have brought up to me that's really upset them, and people were pointing to Mayor Dungis and saying they didn't think he did enough when motels were used in Rutland to house the unhoused population during the pandemic. It became a real flashpoint in the city. And, you know, it was kind of an emergency situation, but a lot of people were upset. And just the fact that it's affecting the unhoused. It's also affecting people that want to buy moderately priced homes, people that have, you know, just your typical job can't afford housing here. So, yeah, I think it's affecting all economic levels because, you know, the hospital has trouble recruiting people because there's no house for them to buy.
Yeah. Well, there's also a crowded race right now for the Board of Aldermen, a.k.a. the city council. What can you tell us about those races?
The Board of Aldermen is kind of one of those interesting races. I had several voters this morning tell me that those were the races they were paying a lot of attention to because, in fact, it's the Board of Aldermen that really affect local residents. And I think that's true. Sometimes we forget about that and we point to the big ticket items. You know, people talk about voting and, oh, the president, but they don't think about, you know, during presidential races, they don't think about lower ticket races. And in this one, the Board of Aldermen has a lot of folks are running, some people that are very well known, and 12 candidates, in fact, are running for 6 seats. Even former Mayor Dave Allaire is running to go back on the Board of Aldermen. He had been president of the Board of Aldermen for many years. So I think it'll be interesting seeing what trajectory the Board of Aldermen takes, because it could completely change, or a lot of incumbents could be reelected. It's hard to say.
I also hear you were talking with the Board of Aldermen's current president just yesterday about a bond vote that he sees as critical for Rutland's future. What's going on there?
Yeah, voters are being asked to approve a $3.8 million bond vote specifically geared to capital improvements. It'll be paid for by the city's new 1% sales tax, but it's going to be used to improve city-owned buildings and water and wastewater and stormwater improvements and repairs. Rutland has a lot of aging infrastructure. Streets and sidewalks are constantly needing to be fixed. That's like a problem every community in Vermont grapples with, right? But, you know, this $3.8 million capital improvement bond is hopefully, according to local lawmakers, going to kind of set aside a pot of money to deal with that better and to look forward rather than to be reactive. Michael Talbot, the president of the Rutland City Board of Aldermen, said he's laser focused. He has no idea whether voters will pass it or not. He's hopeful. And I was talking to a voter just this morning who hadn't voted yet. And when I asked him about this particular bond vote, he said, you know, I'm really on the fence. I know it's important. I know our infrastructure is aging in Rutland, but he said, I'm older and I don't want to put this on the backs of my kids and grandkids and the younger people that live in town. So he wasn't sure whether he was going to vote for it or not.
Yeah, it seems like there's so much uncertainty right now, not just at the state level, but at the national level. In talking to voters today in Rutland, Nina, have you been hearing anything about how President Donald Trump's calls for federal funding cuts are affecting voters in Rutland and the projects that they might be considering right now?
I think there's a lot of uncertainty. We were hearing about that. You know, people are talking about it in Rutland, but I was hearing about it last night at my own town meeting in the town of Chittenden. A lot of concern, a lot of people saying, you know, we just don't know what's going to happen. We don't know how any of these, you know, funding shortfalls are going to impact us at the local level. So, yeah, that's something that I've been hearing a lot about. And also just the disconnect, the hyper-partisanship at the federal level, and, you know, protests that went on this past weekend in Waitsfield when the vice president came to visit. It's got a lot of people talking and kind of wringing their hands and kind of wondering, how does that sugar out at the local level with our own politicians? And it's a question that I put to a Rutland City voter named John O'Connor. He and his wife Sheila were voting this morning. And I just said, well, how does that federal disconnect make you think about local voting and the politics here at you know, the city level? And this is what he had to say.
You know, I think people like controversy, and the kind of messiness of politics right now is, I think, will seep down to local levels in some ways if people allow it to. And so that's my big thing, is that if you allow all the noise to confuse what's going on here, you know, that's not good for people who are looking out for the Rutland area. So
again, that's John O'Connor. He's a Rutland City voter. And I liked what he said, if we let it. If we let it happen.
If we let it seep down.
Yes.
Another semi-connected to maple syrup and the sugar and season metaphor. Just like, see how it sugars out.
Sorry.
I loved it.
I've been living in Vermont too long.
It's very timely. Right in that season. Nina Keck, thank you so much for giving us this on-the-ground look at what is going on in Rutland today on Town Meeting Day. We really appreciate your time.
You're welcome.
Well, let's head now to Caledonia County, where reporter Lexi Krupp is in Linden. Lexi, how's it going there?
Hey, pretty good. The floor vote just wrapped up, so some people are still milling around and voting by Australian ballot, but it's pretty quiet now in the gym.
Yeah, so tell us a little bit about the scene. You said you're in a gym. What does Linden's town meeting look like?
Yeah, so this was the first year they've been, they had a floor vote since 2020, and it was held in the gym attached to the municipal office building. And it was a little bit rough. There was no sound system, and the gym needs some repairs, so a part of it was roped off. Even, you know, before 2020, they had held town meeting in different locations, so this was the first time it was being held here. But it was a pretty good turnout, almost 100 people here. Most of the chairs that were set up were full.
So as you mentioned, this is a significant town meeting for Linden. It's the first in-person meeting since the pandemic. Do you know why they didn't come back in person earlier?
You know, Governor Phil Scott enabled towns to hold an Australian ballot instead of an in-person vote for 4 years. And so that's what, you know, until last year. And so that's what the town decided to do. And this was the first year that they were required to hold a floor vote.
And there was also a vote about whether or not to go to Australian ballot regularly. That's the system of voting in privacy on, you know, a uniform printed out ballot rather than in public during a big meeting. Talk to us about that vote. What was the response? What were the results?
Yeah, well, the town select board really presented this as a way to, you know, Australian ballot is a lot more accessible. More people often come out to vote, especially folks who would be working during the day. But that argument ultimately did not sway voters. The proposal to switch to Australian ballot was voted down after a pretty heated debate. Former state senator Joe Benning spoke about this. He was also the town moderator for many years.
Let's take a listen.
Yeah.
Democracy was never meant to be convenient. If we keep ceding our ability to meet as a group and come here and debate, that troubles me deeply.
So that, you know, it could have been that this was the first town meeting day floor vote since 2020 and the last, but going forward, you know, they'll continue to have a floor vote based on the vote today, and they're gonna work out this. It'll probably be in the gym, and they'll make some improvements just to make it a little more comfortable for people.
Yeah. Well, speaking of infrastructure improvements, Linden was hit really hard by flooding last summer and the summer before that. It knocked out bridges and destroyed homes and washed away roads. Were any of the measures being discussed today about flood recovery or resiliency?
Yeah, in the budget, a number of items included expenses related to flooding this past summer, like paying volunteer firefighters who were responding to calls and repairing highway damage and just expenses related to cleanup. They also, in the budget, included some more swift water rescue equipment for the fire department, along with, you know, ropes and lighting and air tanks and hoses and nozzles and all that stuff. So it was repeatedly referred to, yeah, throughout the meeting.
And I read in VT Digger that Linden had to take out a $15 million line of credit after last year's flooding to repair roads and its municipal office building and a bridge and water and sewer plants. And to put that in perspective, that's more than twice the amount of Linden's annual budget, which is a little more than $7 million. And Linden and many other towns are counting on FEMA and the federal government at large to cover a large percentage of these recovery costs. In light of the president's calls for cuts to federal grant funding, I'm curious if you've heard a concern among Linden residents that their town could go further into debt, into the red.
Yeah, one voter brought this up during, you know, the back and forth and was just saying, really, like, are there any shorter term options that we're considering to improve flood resiliency rather than waiting on these FEMA grants? And the, you know, select board member who responded said, we're going to continue to rely on FEMA funding because we haven't heard anything to indicate that those federal funds are going away. And we can't afford to, you know, to pay for some of these big repairs just on our, but, you know, the town itself. Yeah. So, yeah, they said, you know, we're not prepared to increase tax burden on folks. We know people are really, you know, hurting. So they're going to, they're doing this federal grant route and hoping that pulls through.
Vermont Public Reporter Lexi Krupp is in Linden today for town meeting day. Lexi, thanks so much for talking with us.
Thanks for having me.
While many towns are focused on internal issues, like we just heard from reporters Lexi Krupp and Nina Keck, some are debating more national or even international concerns. Coming up, we'll learn more about the history of town meeting day votes on things like nuclear arms freezes, anti-war resolutions, and more. That's in just a minute. Stay with us. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Michaela Lafrac. History often repeats itself on town meeting day. Take school lunches. Right now, Vermonters are debating whether the state should provide free meals for all public school children. But back in 1950, on town meeting day, the town of Pittsford in Rutland County was considering funding its own school lunch program. The U.S. Department of Defense produced a video about it called A Town Solves a Problem.
Finally, the time comes to discuss the granting of funds for the hot lunch program. Since this proposal involves the appropriation of new funds, the reasons for it must be stoutly presented, and interest runs high. But some do not like new ideas, and the opposition spokesman argues that many things must be considered when the taxpayer's money is an issue. Hot lunches are nice, but children in his day did well without them. This plan seems to favor just a few, he says, so they must have good reasons. Dr. Benton, the much-respected town physician, asks to speak. He is concerned about preventing of illness among school children and urges this expenditure of public money as a means of protecting health. He argues that public health is the concern of all. Yet, the opposition still believe this is a selfish proposal. And so, a vote is called for from the floor. Now, arguments for and against are all in. Each person must make up his own mind, yes or no.
Again, that's from 1950, about a Pittsford vote. But again, it sounds familiar, right? For decades, Vermonters have also used Town Meeting Day to debate issues that go far beyond their municipality's borders. This year, for example, multiple towns are voting on what are called apartheid-free community pledges in regard to the situation in Israel and Palestine. Joining us to discuss the history of all these types of votes is Susan Clark. She's the Middlesex Town Moderator, a position she's held for many years, as well as the co-author of Slow Democracy, Rediscovering Community and Bringing Decision-Making Back Home with Woden Teachout. Susan, welcome back to the show. I always love catching up with you this time of year.
Happy to be here.
So when was the first time that you're aware of that one of these town meeting day debates on a national or international issue really broke through and made national news?
Yeah, I mean, it's a great question. I'm not a, you know, an actual historian, but I love looking at how, you know, how we in Vermont, how New England talks about its issues. And, you know, if you think back in the day, the towns really were the form of government that we had town meetings before we had a state, you know, and so it does make sense that we would have been talking about these kinds of things. And, you know, you mentioned the whole nuclear freeze thing, which I think we'll talk about. But when I was reading what UVM Professor Frank Bryan wrote about that, he said that those nuclear freeze debates received more national and international attention than any town meeting issues since Vermonters opposed Jefferson's Embargo Act of 1808.
Oh, wow.
I was like, wow, what was
the old Embargo Act?
The good old Embargo Act. No, but I mean, this was actually, it was quite hot. It was Jefferson saying, shutting down all trade with Canada. And this goes back to, you know, the British impressment of American troops, kind of ultimately what led to the War of 1812. But, you know, Burlington, Shelburne, Milton, Castleton, they all called on Congress to have Jefferson lift that embargo with Canada. Mm.
Yeah. And then in the 1980s, there was this push to make a statement about about nuclear weapons and the standoff between the U.S. and the Soviet Union. What do you know about that time?
Yeah. So 1982, it was more than 150 Vermont town meetings passed resolutions calling for, you know, what they called at the time, a nuclear freeze, the U.S. and the Soviet Union to stop developing nuclear bombs. And if you think about it, 1982, the Cold War had been going on for decades. There had been this recent increase in tension because the Soviet Union had invaded Afghanistan, and people were terrified. They were really tired of having this threat hanging over their heads. You know, President Reagan was about to address the nation on this whole situation. And there's this great quote from Jim Lehrer, the McNeil-Lehrer Report on PBS, was interviewing Dan Quayle. He was a senator then. It was before he was vice president. And Jim Lehrer says, "You said it's not going to be the folks at town meeting who are going to resolve this thing. But isn't that what has happened? Isn't that the reason that the president is speaking on it tonight?" Mm. Because the people at town meeting raised this issue. And Dan Quayle said, no, that's definitely, he said, it wasn't some grassroots caucus taking place in Vermont. And he said, no, this is military experts that are making the call. But, you know, it certainly did raise awareness, got people's attention.
Yeah. I found this 1982 New York Times article reporting on all these resolutions, and they quoted this one Putney resident that was arguing that this issue should be on town meeting day ballots because if there was a nuclear threat, thousands of people living in New England cities would move to Vermont, which was part of the official federal crisis relocation plan. And he said, if dealing with the question of civil defense is town business, it is also town business to deal with the root cause and not just the symptom. The root cause is the nuclear arms race. I found that coverage just fascinating. But Susan, let's jump ahead a couple decades to the early mid-2000s. That's when a number of Vermont towns passed resolutions calling for an investigation into the use of the state's National Guard in the Iraq War and for the withdrawal of U.S. troops from Iraq. I wonder if you could talk to us about these resolutions and also just the fact that these are non-binding measures. So what exactly does that mean?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I remember that 2005 one. I mean, Vermont at the time had the second highest mobilization rate per capita in any state. That whole, Iraq thing hit home very, very hard. At the same time, I think there was at least one town, I think it was Sunderland, who had a resolution to support the troops in Iraq. So it was very much on people's minds. But you have to remember that in At its foundation, what town meeting is the, on issues of finance and governance, we are the legislative body of a town. So, you know, at the national level, you've got the president and Congress, you know, at the state level, you have the legislature and the governor. But in towns, we have the select board as the executive branch. And on issues of finance and governance, we are the legislators. We're not electing other people to govern for us. We are that body. We decide on budgets. We amend from the floor. You know, government is us. It's we. When we walk in that room. And so that power is absolutely real. And its decisions are binding. But the power that we have is very, very local. So when you start, you know, it would be kind of like if Vermont decided to go tell Wyoming what to do, you know, it's like, no, we're Vermont. we only have power here.
It'd be kind of a fun power trip for a day though, right?
Yeah, it could be sort of fun. So when a town meeting starts to give advice outside of its borders, I guess a couple things can happen. One thing, it can certainly increase turnout, right? If somebody's very interested in that topic, it can increase turnout. But ultimately, it's often used for publicity. It's often used to raise awareness or as an advocacy tool. You know, when you say to people, 150 towns voted to do X, it sounds powerful. It's sort of a glorified public opinion poll in a way that can get a lot of publicity. But for the people who are involved, you have to ask what happens because they are, it can feel confusing. It can ultimately actually feel disempowering. It can kind of have collateral damage on the institution itself, because rather than being that legislature that the town meetings are designed to be, deliberating and deciding on action items we can amend, you know, that make a difference, a real true difference locally, this becomes more like a public hearing, where people can just kind of hold forth. Those have a very different track record.
Yeah, let me ask you a question about that, Susan, because you're a longtime town moderator there in Middlesex. So last year, a number of Vermont municipalities, as I noted earlier, passed these non-binding resolutions about the Israel-Hamas war. A number of other towns are voting on the same on similar resolutions this year. We got a ton of emails about this topic ahead of today's show. And we're not going into that specific resolution or the debate, but I am curious, as a town moderator, if you have any suggestions or advice for other moderators or town officials on how to keep these conversations, these town meeting day debates, focused on connecting people with their neighbors, understanding values versus division.
Yeah. I mean, I guess two things. First of all, we really are. Have you ever like tried to put up a picture on a wall and you didn't have a hammer and so you tried to nail that into the nail something? If you use the wrong tool, you can damage the wall. And Robert's Rules is really designed for decision making. It's on purpose. It's pretty hierarchical. It's linear. If you think about General Robert, who invented them, he was not only a brigadier general right after the Civil War, but he was an engineer. He was trying to help standardize and demystify democratic decision making. But town meeting was never intended to be the only time we get together. It's intended to be a decision-making moment, but what is supposed to lead into town meeting are those values clarification conversations. So town meetings aren't great for exploring values. You were supposed to have done that ahead of time. And there are some wonderful tools for doing that, for getting people together in small groups, sharing their common experiences, identifying their values, letting everybody speak. I would urge a town that was going to pick up a hard issue like this to have pre-meetings around those very specific topics so that people really can speak their hearts and get at some of those difficult tensions that we hold between oftentimes two good things, you know, things that we care about together. Yeah. At the meeting itself,
Bring pie. That's my advice.
We do the best we can. Yeah. It's interesting. I mean, I'm not every town has to decide what they want to do. But if you don't want to discuss an article at a floor meeting, you do have the opportunity to, you know, decline to take a position, not pass or fail it. But colloquially, it's just called a motion to pass over.
Hmm. Well, I want to play one more piece of archival tape that we have for today. It's from 2008. And this was when Brattleboro residents there were voting on a measure instructing police to arrest President George W. Bush and Vice President Dick Cheney for crimes against the Constitution. This was also in the midst of the Iraq War. This is a report from WPTZ. Let's take a listen.
On town meeting day, people in Brattleboro will vote on whether the president and vice president should be indicted and arrested for war crimes if they ever set foot in Vermont. But this isn't the first time Vermonters have taken on the Bush White House. Last year, the state legislator voted on Bush's impeachment, but nothing happened.
How many Cossacks are we shipping home every day? And so far, what have we achieved in the Iraq War? Absolutely nothing.
Ron Taylor is a fierce advocate of the proposal. He knows that the town may not have the authority to issue an arrest warrant, but he thinks the proposal alone will accomplish the underlying goal.
Even if it wasn't legal, I think the message should be known that we don't want you here. We want you to get out of here. We want someone in there that's responsible. We want someone that's going to stop all this stuff.
Susan, do you remember that time?
Tough times. Wow. Yeah. And it's, yes, I do. And, gosh, you know, we just had J.D. Vance visiting here, and there were a lot of people who were upset about that. So where could this conversation go in the future? I shudder to think.
Yeah, well, it's fascinating to hear about all the different ways that towns that are very hyper-local communities are addressing some of these national and international concerns. And thanks to everybody who wrote in today telling us what is bringing you to the polls or to your meeting this town meeting day. Middlesex Town Moderator Susan Clark, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
And we have to take one more quick break, but you have got to stay with us, because when we come back, we're going to hear what residents of one Vermont town were talking about more than 40 years ago at their town meeting day. This is a special archival story from NPR. That's in just a minute. Stay with us. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Michaela Lefrak. Part of the magic of town meeting day is that for many towns, it never really changes. The same people are there year after year in the same school gym or firehouse with the same potluck dishes, arguing in a neighborly way over the same core issues. Let's go back, shall we, to 1982, 43 years ago. Back then, towns were voting on school budgets and snowplows, just like they are today. Most towns also debated an issue dominating international headlines, banning nuclear weapons in the U.S. and the Soviet Union. In 1982, Ronald Reagan was the U.S. president, Richard Snelling, Dick Snelling was Vermont's governor, and Bernie Sanders was not a senator, but the mayor of Burlington. That year, NPR's Leslie Breeding traveled to Stratford, Vermont, in Orange County for town meeting day to capture the community spirit and share it with the rest of the country. Let's listen.
The earliest sign of spring in many New England states is the town meeting. Most people get the day off from work and gather up the kids and head for a meeting hall to talk about how their town will be run. It's a tradition dating back to church meetings centuries ago. We visited Stratford, Vermont, a small and secluded village of trade and agriculture and beauty. At its center, a remarkable meeting house used just once a year.
7:30 in the morning, Ike Kendall, he's the road commissioner, starts the wood fires in the number 2 stoves and the big number 5 up near the stage. It's March 2nd, still cold, 2 feet of snow on the ground outside.
Yesterday morning we was up here, it was about 20 below zero in this building. It was cold.
Good morning.
It's 9:30, and folks start arriving in groups up the hill. Neighbors who may not have seen each other all winter greet and exchange news. The hall is a one-room meeting house built in 1799. It's tall, wooden, white-painted, topped with a spire. The windows are high and narrow, like a church.
It's an impressive feeling to walk into that building. It's an impressive feeling to see it from the outside, first of all, because of its excellent location and its great severity, an austere building. And you walk in and it's austere inside, and I at least very much get the feeling that a lot of generations have done their business here.
Stratford Town Meeting will now come to order. This morning I have asked Lori Hubbard to lead us in the Pledge of Allegiance to the flag. So if you'll all stand, please, she will lead us in the Pledge of Allegiance.
Stratford residents have carried into the meeting copies of the town report, which they've studied for a few weeks. Local officials, the three selectmen, the town clerk, and others, are accountable to each family in this room. Everyone knows how much Stratford spent and how much it took in, down to the last dog license. They can see the proposals for next year. Each year is more complex than the preceding.
If you'll turn to page 10 and 11 in your town report, for anybody who might be unfamiliar with these figures and find the figures in any way confusing, one of the easiest and most simplest ways to see the significant items on the budget are to compare column one, which is the 1981 budget, with column three, which is the 1982.
I think it's changed because the younger people want more things than the older people did. They want better roads, they want better schools, a lot of extras that we didn't think were important. Of course, all these things cost more.
Those of you who have been keeping running track of the tennis courts know that 2 years ago, humps appeared in the tennis court. Last year, major cracking occurred. Sooner or later, those cracks are going to open up again, and we will have a similar problem. I also want you to understand that the $2,800 does not address the matter of the humps that are in the court. They are a real problem. Nobody has come along with a suggestion that everybody is enthused about. The only suggestion we have had to date is to bring a steamroller on there and try and squash them down. There are two schools of thought on that. One says do it in July when the temperature is in the 90s because the asphalt will be warm enough. The other school says, no, that's all wrong. What you need to do is squash down the dirt, not the asphalt, and you should do that early in the spring when it's good and wet. That's where we are at the moment.
Article 8, to elect the following town officers.
For a couple of weeks, those who want to hold office or be reelected have called around to friends and neighbors and said so. At town meeting, the election of officers is courteous. Some turn down nominations made today in jest or friendship. There is no discussion of qualifications or merits or their lack. Everyone knows everyone. To campaign is almost impolite.
I would say it's an excellent dramatization of exactly what direct democracy entails, all the weaknesses and all of the strengths of a direct democracy.
And years ago, used to be a little more alcohol slung around here than there is now. You know, they used to get on hard cider and hard stuff and come in here and then they get in a good chew. But that's many years ago. And I've seen fights out here, and this guy has too. Right, Melvin?
What's that?
Fights out here right on doorstep.
What were their fights about?
Oh, they'd be fighting over, like, select men, you know, one get mad at the other and wanted to have it all cut and dried, and I'm going to hand the keys to another guy here and he's going to have select men, but he wouldn't get it, so they go out here and fight. They'd fight.
Prepare and cast your ballots, please, then, for Daryl Hotchkiss, Lois Kendall, Charles Judd. Now, in order to ballot and come to the ballot boxes, please come down the center aisle and go off to the side, either right or left. That's down the center aisle only.
I don't know if they do it at all town meetings. We have to furnish our own paper, and it can be any kind of paper. They don't give you any. If you vote for the officers, you
bring your own paper and tear off a little piece of paper and write on it.
He's got 91.
Put it in the ballot box. And I've known people who have forgotten to bring paper to go and tear off a piece of the paper tablecloth to use for write ballots. And we had cardboard boxes for ballot boxes.
They had those up until this last year, didn't they?
No, they had wooden ones for a while. Now we have the real thing with locks in.
Results of balloting for First Constable, 137 ballots cast. Necessary for election, 69. Root has 4, Eastman, 42, and Guile Kendall, 91. Guile Kendall elected First Constable for 1 year.
The job that I have as constable is supposed to be the meanest damn man in town. They always said that in town meeting years ago. No, we can't have him. He isn't mean enough.
Guile Kendall, town constable. He wears a 6-point star on his gray uniform. His job today, to watch over the meeting, see that all goes smoothly.
All it takes is 3 people on the floor, and they can run the town meeting. They can get it wherever they want it. Those old-timers that knew just how to do it, old Buttermilk Bill Stone, the late George K. Brown, and another fellow that did move in here, flatlander, you might say, but he was right on his toes. He must have come from a backwoods country somewhere. And they was quick on it. And one would nominate and another would second it and close the motion right then and there. And everybody else had to follow. But them old-timers are gone. And the new style of people we got ain't smart enough to find out how to run the town meeting.
Results of balloting for town agent for 1 year. 169 ballots cast, necessary for election 84, of which Daryl Hodgkiss has 98, and therefore elected town agent for 1 year.
By now, the tops of the wood stoves are no longer visible under bean pots and casseroles and pans full of food for lunch. The smell of it cooking is too much for the voters to bear, and during one ballot, the ranks break and the town meeting tumbles into a lunch recess that lasts longer than it's supposed to. The PTA has outdone itself.
Those are Celia's beans. Olive and Hazel Lewis always bring beans.
See, the lunch is a big deal at town meeting. It's a classic church supper extravaganza type of thing. Lots of kinds of pies and cookies and sandwiches for a little lunch and casseroles and other things for a bigger meal.
And baked beans.
And baked beans. And last year, the baked beans were being kept on the wood stove to be kept warm. And evidently the wood stove got too hot, the casserole couldn't take the pressure, and suddenly there was a large gas from those people standing near it and many bodies leaping away and the sizzle of burning baked beans filled the room. Black smoke goes to the ceiling as these beans hitting the very hot surface of the wood stove, of course, were instantly vaporizing.
When the last piece of cherry pie is gone, Ike Kendall stokes the fires again. The sun's gone in for a while, and it's snowing a bit. The most difficult issues are ahead.
We're back to our town warning. Article 11, to see if the town will vote to authorize the delinquent tax collector to advertise for tax sale.
Stratford's been generous with folks who get behind on paying taxes to the town. Now selectmen warn of a brand new concern, a possible budget deficit. And there's the problem of whether to reassess the value of everyone's land. It hasn't been done for 16 years. This afternoon talk on taxes and the land inspires more people to get up and speak than the meeting has heard all day.
Mrs. Freeman.
Well, supposing your property, say 100 acres, say, is probably might be worth $10,000. If you owe $1,000 taxes on it, for instance, would they sell land to pay the $1,000 or would they sell the whole piece?
It's my understanding that the town cannot subdivide the land to sell only that portion equal to the amount of taxes due. And again, my understanding is that they have to sell the whole piece.
Yes, but supposing the piece is worth more than the taxes are, does the landowner get the difference?
It's my understanding that there is no established policy about this at present in the town. And it strikes me that we're going from extreme laxness to a violently punitive measure all in one jump. Isn't there some more reasonable proposal that could be substituted for this one?
I don't know. I think 1 year is awful short. I know my grandfather lost his house and his farm during the Depression, and it's not because he didn't want to pay his taxes. It was a situation in which people couldn't make money and people couldn't get work. And I would say there's possibilities in this country of a situation like that happening again.
As everybody knows, I own a large section of land. I own 400 acres, a little over. Now, if $100 sold for around 98, and that's four times my tax. Now, I paid over $1,200 this year. That would be close to $5,000. I couldn't possibly pay it.
Mrs. Freeman pointed out that she pays $1,200 taxes on her 400 acres. I pay over $1,000 on my three. And I think there's a little discrepancy there that should somehow be rectified.
Recognize the lady. I don't know what your name is.
I don't have any answers to the questions, but I just have an observation that I'd like to make, and that there are some things about Stratford that I hold really, that I value a lot. And it's the village that we have and the people that live in it and Mrs. Freeman's land that's not subdivided and everything. And it seems to me that we're going to force people like Mrs. Freeman and other landowners in this town to not be able to afford it. And it's not, I mean, there's, I don't have any answers, but it just seems really sad to me.
The debates take hours. Finally, Stratford votes yes to reassessing the land. Despite its fears, the vote is almost unanimous, and it votes to remain generous with those who can't pay their taxes on time. The town can wait for tax money. It doesn't like to see land taken away from folks in trouble. It's dusk outside. The meeting's gone on longer than any in recent memory. The final question is out of the ordinary for Stratford's town meeting. It calls on the Vermont legislature to ask for a freeze on the production of nuclear weapons in the United States and the Soviet Union.
Those of us who are in favor of this feel that it is an issue of survival, not in the long term, but in a much shorter term than we would like to hope.
We're here in this state, in this town, in this meeting because we care about the quality of life for ourselves and our children. And this all could be turned to vapor in about 10 seconds.
Two have spoken in favor. There is no dissent. They've batted this one around dinner tables, and everyone has come, it seems, to see reason in this article. Whatever threatens Stratford, its children, its countryside, is town business. The vote is unanimous in favor of the article.
Is there any other business?
Move we adjourn.
Second the
motion. The motion has been moved and seconded that we adjourn. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed with a nay. The ayes appear to have it, and the meeting has adjourned.
Stratford, Vermont almost will run itself now until next year's meeting, shepherded by the town clerk and the selectmen who meet occasionally. Neighbors now have made dates to supper, renewed summer contracts for barter and plowing rights, and they head home.
Now, night.
Hey, it was a good meeting, huh?
Yeah.
Knowing there will be no surprises from their local government in the coming year, they've just spent the day deep in democracy, deciding it all for themselves.
That was your salad. That was terrific.
Oh, thank you.
Delicious. Millet?
No, wheat berries, actually.
Wheat berries.
They told me to make coleslaw.
This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Well, you can't beat that music from NPR in 1982. That story from Stratford's town meeting was reported by NPR's Leslie Breeding. Special thanks to Michael Cullen at NPR, who engineered this original piece, and to Vermont Public's Phil Edfers for helping us get this story on our airwaves. Today's show is directed by Aaliyah Papes. Our managing producer is John Ahrens, and our producers are Andrea Lorien and Daniela Fierro. Our call screener today was Rick Barrett. I'm Michaela LaFrac. Thank you so much for listening, and we will catch up again soon.